This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason is deep into interviews for a new police chief, and he has a panel of community leaders right along with him.
This is a huge decision that I want more eyes looking at this, which is why I formed the selection committee.
Eric Stock talks about the first year on the job for the Bloomington City Manager, plus Ryan Denham delves into the huge transition the state's child welfare agency is going through. He talks with Doris Houston, director of Illinois State University Center for Child Welfare and Adoption Studies. Tim Shelley reports on gun stores going out of business because state police aren't putting out licensing rules. And Dana Vollmer reports on a mural going up in Peoria to reunite a neighborhood and prove love is stronger than bullets. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Tim Gleason recently marked a year as Bloomington City Manager. He says the city has made improvements in the way it gets things done since he came on board, including better preparing council members before they cast votes. But Gleason tells WGLT's Eric Stock he is not going to grade himself.
Some of the community leaders, elected officials, I'll leave that to them. I guess I can respond this way and say it's been a quick year. I think we've accomplished, a lot of stuff for the community, and very proud of the first year.
How would you grade the city council and city staff in this transition? Not only a transition for city administration, but also for the council itself with four new members.
Well, this is one area. It was a priority, and it was very clear from the council, the mayor and the council that hired me a year ago, that they were not satisfied with how some of the things that played out in some of the council meetings. If you remember early on, eliminated the special meetings to hold those for truly special events, moved up the council meeting to 6 o'clock, and just brought some uniformity to the council meetings themselves and holding special meetings for when they're truly special. The title, special meeting. But the council members, they've been very responsive, and I'm convinced they were not being prepped adequately. And some things played out in the council floor that otherwise could have been prevented, which is not suggesting unanimous votes, which is not suggesting healthy debate on different topics. But the council's been very responsive, and they're very appreciative of the effort to prep them for the meetings.
So how are you and city staff better preparing them before they cast their votes?
Well, deeper dive into the council agenda, making very clear whose responsibility it is for the different items, and that there's some items that just rise to the level that there's additional things to make sure that the council is aware of. I think what you found in the past was a lot of uncertainty. You can read a memo, you can read a council packet, but sometimes you need to make sure that there's one, two, three, four different points that really stand out that council needs to be aware of. Not dissimilar to the finance director's report that I implemented monthly. It's a high level report, which does not take away from a deeper dive into any specific area, sort of that same approach to prepping council for the regular council agenda.
Now, the city council sets policy, of course, but I imagine a city manager would have an agenda to two, or at least a to-do list. How much of that have you accomplished in the first year?
I'm satisfied, and I say that I'm satisfied because I get those kind of comments from the council. It is their vision for the community. I'm left to find a way, if you will. Some things are not unanimous. Some things you really have to dive into the comments and the side discussions that have occurred with elected officials to see where you land on the firmest ground, and you know that you've got a majority. But I think we've done a good job over the last year.
One of the more significant pieces of legislation the City Council passed this year was the gas tax increase of 4 cents, and this was only a few months before the state passed a 19-cent hike. Do you concern yourself that that much of a hike could put drivers at a breaking point, or they might consider going to normal to fill up as they did not pass the local motor fuel tax increase?
Well, I can respond, to the different parts of that question. One, whether it's 4 cents from the city, 8 cents total, 19 additional cents from the state, I'm not dismissive of the fact, and you'll never hear me say, well, it's just 4 cents, because I understand over the course of a month, over the course of a year, there's some budgets in this community that, that's impactful. I understand that. I also, and not that it conflicts with, but also up against a strong desire and a strong need. Really originating from the community, that we've got roads to fix, and we have to find a way to pay for those. So it's a very important component is telling that story, an accurate and transparent tracking of the money in and how the money is being spent.
Hey, this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason. It's been 1 year since he became the city manager for Bloomington, and likely one of your next major tasks will be to name a new police chief after Clay Wheeler's retirement. How close are you to filling that position?
What we've done, actually had an excellent pool of applicants, I think 63 total. Nearly 45 met the qualifications that we, very similar to what you'll see on any job posting on the International Association of Chiefs of Police. What we did is narrowed to 14 that met the qualifications, and then of that 14, the selection team selected 8 to bring in for interviews. Those were completed, and the selection team, I've been out of the office for the past couple of days, and selection team's going to meet, and we're going to discuss what the next steps are. Probably had a little bit of a overly aggressive timeline, because this is so important to the community, in no rush to make a bad decision.
What are the most important characteristics that you're looking for in our new chief?
Well, a law enforcement career, education, not just the law enforcement type of advanced education, but, what has been accomplished, early on in a career in the form of a bachelor's or master's degree. I've got some candidates that are attorneys. Some have PhDs. It's pretty standard that a bachelor's degree is a minimum requirement. But as far as a community leader, and that's exactly what the police chief is, if I had to prioritize, I'm going to say that my first priority is that police department itself. We've got an excellent police department, and I want to find the right candidate, that can effectively lead that department. And then obviously the community, how they're responsive to the elected officials, and definitely me, because in an organizational chart, they work for me. So there's a number of factors, a number of qualities that we need in the next police chief.
And you had a lengthy career in law enforcement yourself before going into city administration. How does that experience and that background inform the selection process for you?
Well, what I've done is, in this instance, I've created a selection committee with leaders, influential people within the community. And have not relinquished, but I want that view from the different people, that make up that selection committee. And I'm not dodging, the question. I'm very proud of my law enforcement background. My dad was retired from the state police. I have an uncle that was in municipal law enforcement. Got a son-in-law that's in municipal law enforcement. So, you know, it's in my blood. But this is a huge decision that I want more eyes looking at this, which is why I formed the selection committee.
And when we conducted our exit interview with Chief Wheeler, he naturally stood up for his department and said that he hoped that internal candidates would be considered. Here's what he said.
So they need somebody that's going to be able to come in, see that, and recognize that. And obviously the internal candidates that we have know that and will be able to see that. Hopefully they don't just come in and think they know how to do everything and change a bunch of things, because they could mess up a good thing.
Is that a fair sentiment?
Yeah, I think that is accurate. You know, I'm an internal candidate person, but sometimes, you know, the best choice is not your internal candidate. You know, that's a department no different than any other department. You know, what sort of succession planning has there been? Law enforcement is a little bit more unique than an HR department or a public works department, but there is so much going on nationally with policing that, you know, an outside candidate could emerge as the candidate, you know, for those reasons, you know, that it's a different look. But to Chief Wheeler's point, you know, regardless of who the candidate is, they have to, I'm going to go back to what I said previously. My number one priority is to find somebody that fits for that police department.
And when Chief Wheeler left, you named two assistant chiefs to serve as interim chiefs in succeeding months, Greg Scott and Dan Doneth, to Department of Veterans. The move seemed a little unique. Could we interpret that these are two candidates auditioning for the job?
You could. And both Assistant Chief Doneth, Assistant Chief Scott, both applied for the position. And I felt it was the fairest approach.
One of the first tasks that Chief Wheeler was given when he became chief a year ago, shortly before you joined the city, was to implement a policy to ensure protections for undocumented immigrants, something the council was unable to achieve legislatively and has not since addressed. Is that going to be an expectation for the new chief, or might that be going back before the city council at some point?
No, it's not something that is on the radar for the next police chief. Walk through that just prior to my arrival, and maybe a year prior when Brendan Hefner was still the police chief. Welcoming City was a topic. Chief Wheeler gets appointed May of 2018. I believe that there was still ongoing public discussion about this, and Chief Wheeler was directed to write a policy by the mayor. In steps me, July of 2018. September of 2018, Chief Wheeler shares with me that he's got the draft policy that the mayor had directed him to create, very similar to what the town of Normal adopted. And my decision at that time, and it was based on a conversation with Clay, was, you know, do we have a problem in the community? He said, no, not at all. I said, what this draft policy captures, is this something that the department already does? And he said, definitely, yes, it is. If there was to be an incident like this, high-level command know exactly what to do, who to get involved. And I said, you know, I'm 2 months into this, saw some positive direction from council, felt that there was not a need to bring this forward. And I told Clay just to hang on to the draft policy. I was satisfied that, you know, the department knew how to operate if and when something like this would occur. And I also knew that with that current council, there was not majority support. So why bring up a discussion that is going to play out, you know, in a way that, you know, we were trying to avoid at that time?
But with the new council, is that something the council is going to revisit?
I have not received any direction from this new body. And actually, I was quoted in another media outlet that, you know, majority of the council may support this. That's not an accurate statement. What we will do is respond to what a majority of this new council wants, and this is not something that they have brought up yet.
And that's not something that the new police chief will be addressing or looking to change anytime soon, or will that be the expectation of the new chief?
That is not. You know, when I think of priorities for this incoming police chief, that's not one of them. That's one where I'm satisfied that the police department currently operates in a way that they should. And if we need to formalize this at the direction of the council, which has not occurred yet, and let's say it's a symbolic gesture rather than a true need, then we will follow the lead of the council. But I've not received those marching orders yet.
And this is Sound Ideas with Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason after 1 year on the job at City Hall. And, of course, a lot of what city government has to do is react to events as they happen. One unanticipated development came recently, State Farm announcing that a deal to sell their former downtown headquarters had fell through. The company now plans to tear down the building. Now, Mayor Terry Renner had said the city is informally talking with the company to somehow save the facility. Councilmember Jen Carrillo is planning a public discussion on this as well. What can the city do at this point?
I think the city does, you know, exactly what we've done through the time that it was being marketed. State Farm, Fortune 50 company. They're going to play their cards, hold their cards very close to the vest. I understand and I respect that. When you start dealing with a public body and have open conversations, FOIA applies to any relationship or conversation with the city. They're a private entity. We have had discussions, and really those discussions were, you know, nothing more, but it was significant, was that the city sets ready to be a part of any conversation when State Farm decides that we should be. So they knew that during this marketing stage. We were notified hour and a half before the press release was going, you know, came out. And since then, not surprisingly, there's a fair amount of interest. I mean, this is a huge building, you know, in the downtown of Bloomington. It has tremendous significance. And again, we'll follow the lead of State Farm. And I know that the mayor, other council members, Jen is having a Ward 6 town hall meeting, and it's just her. It's going to be held at City Hall. But I know that there's interest, you know, renewed interest, if you will, and exploring possibilities.
And State Farm had said that they'd considered donating the building, but then whoever takes it would be saddled with huge ongoing maintenance costs. Would the city or some private entity be willing to take that on?
Well, again, I've not had a you know, in-depth conversation with my entire elected body, so I'm not sure you know, where you gauge the interest. You know, the best thing would be if there was private interest out there, and you know, through this announcement, maybe there's renewed interest. And they sell off floors, sell off portions of floors, but it's enough that it makes it a viable project for a private interest out there, which is not suggesting the city could not be involved. But if asked, I think that's the, you know, the best approach.
Well, and of course, the city has had a long list of facility needs in the short term and the long term. The public library has been needing more space for years, though they really don't want to move. There's been talk of a new Connect Transit Transfer Center. Mayor Renner has said that City Hall is outdated, built when the city was less than half the size it is now. And of course, there's been talk for years about a downtown hotel. Could any of these or some combination possibly be woven into this kind of project to keep that building from being torn down?
Well, I think it's an accurate statement to say this, that, you know, there's nothing that's off the table of possibilities when we talk about State Farm building. We'll see if some of these conversations, renewed interest, if they take shape, and I'll follow the direction of the council.
And could it be that this building and the planned demolition is maybe just a reflection of modern business reality? Work staffs are more mobile, more nimble. Technology doesn't take up nearly as much space as it did generations ago, to the point that maybe such a building doesn't really have an appropriate use. I mean, is that the fear at this point?
I don't know that it's the fear, but I think that's probably the case with State Farm's decision to vacate that building. I think it was fall of 2017. It was prior to my arrival. But then now with the building and how it's left at this point, there is an operating cost. You know, this thing was marketed, you know, extensively by State Farm and the third-party group that they hired. And there just was not that interest. You know, what I think is actually exciting after the announcement is there does seem to be renewed interest. You know, maybe people that were sort of standing on the sidelines and were assuming that something was going to happen, you know, maybe they get more involved in the conversation. And we'll see where we land on this.
Okay, you had said after the announcement that this is something that should be accepted. Mayor Renner interpreted that as we understand State Farm's clear intentions, but that doesn't mean that it can't be saved somehow.
Oh, I agree with that. And you know, if the comment, you know, you're scrambling to put out a response to a press release that had just occurred, and I was actually in the first round interviews for the police chief. So if there was anything about the comment we must accept, you know, that the intention was this was still not open to the possibilities. That was never my intent.
In our final moments with Tim Gleason, Bloomington City Manager, reflecting on your first year at Bloomington City Hall, any regrets, anything that you would have done differently or you'd like to get another crack at in year two?
No, I'll use a baseball analogy. You know, I don't think that there's been any instances where, you know, we've come to the plate and struck out, you know, but there might be times where, you know, we hit a single or a double, and I'm always one of those that wants to hit a home run every time I come up to the plate. And I think staff is the same way. So no regrets, you know, really feel like we're just getting started, to be quite honest. You know, as I start my second year on the job, excited to do even more and, you know, feel like we're shifting out of first gear into second gear.
That was Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason with WGLT's Eric Stock. Gleason named five people to his police chief search committee, including two of his own staffers, Deputy City Manager Billy Tyus and Economic Development Director as well. They are joined by Brendan Hefner, former Bloomington police chief and current U.S. Marshal for the Central District of Illinois, Don Knapp, the McLean County State's Attorney, and Art Taylor, who chairs the city's Public Safety and Community Relations Board.
Support for WGLT comes from Westminster Village, a locally owned and operated not-for-profit for over 40 years and now expanding the campus in Bloomington. New Westminster Village assisted living and memory support facilities currently under construction. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Tim Shelley reports on how a lack of state guidelines is driving gun dealers out of business in central Illinois. The Illinois Department of Children and Family Services is in a state of major transition. It's being run by a new director and a new governor who are pushing for reforms. And public scrutiny is intense following the high-profile deaths of several children in DCFS orbit earlier this year. Doris Houston is director of the Illinois State University Center for Child Welfare and Adoption Studies. She talks with WGLT's Ryan Denham about the pressures facing DCFS.
We certainly have had a number of high-profile child deaths that have just been devastating to our citizenry. But at the same time, it's certainly an opportunity for change and an opportunity to move forward, to try some new ideas, and to really engage the new leadership that has stepped forward to lead the state's child welfare agency.
And speaking of that new leadership, what do you think of what the Pritzker administration has done so far when it comes to first steps on DCFS and some reforms?
Well, I would say in the short period of time, there seems to be a methodical process that the governor's office and his staff are following. You first want to assess what the concerns are. There have been a number of independent reports that have really looked at a number of structural avenues, as well as practice and training and workforce avenues that need to be addressed. So some of those reports include a report by the Office of the Auditor General. There was a Chapin Hall report that, again, looked at a number of areas within child welfare in terms of outcomes, in terms of workforce training, et cetera. And then DCFS's own Office of Inspector General. So I would think for any new administration, the first place to start would be to do a detailed evaluation of what is working and what is not. Certainly, the governor does not have a lot of time because these are really, really pressing issues that our state is facing.
So the governor and lawmakers came together with the new budget that went into effect about 3 weeks ago now to find some more money for DCFS. It'll get an 11% budget increase, so it's around $130 million in new money. How much of a difference do you think that amount of money makes with a department like DCFS?
It makes a huge difference, particularly when we understand that there has been a trend towards budget cuts with over the past several years. And those budget cuts not only have affected DCFS, but it has really been a devastation to a number of the community-based nonprofit organizations that serve the very families and children that we want to either keep out of DCFS involvement or we rely on them when a child does come into foster care. So a number of the smaller agencies over the past several years have had to close their doors either due to budget cuts or very slow pay, where agencies have had to wait months, sometimes upward of 9 months, to receive their funding. And if you're a small agency that's in the community doing good work, it's difficult to maintain without the funding. So I really look at the increases that have occurred this year as absolutely as essential to really get the agency back on its footing in terms of hiring, in terms of resources, even things we don't think of like data management. All of those kinds of things really, take resources. Mm.
And at the very end of the spring legislative session, right at the end of May and beginning of June, lawmakers unanimously passed SB 193, which is a bill that updates many parts of the state's abused and neglected child reporting law. It's now pending on the governor's desk. What do you think are some of the most significant changes that were included in that bill?
Well, I tell you, that bill is very near and dear to my heart and those of us at the School of Social Work within Illinois State University. This bill extends the time of guardianship for children who have been served by foster care. So whereas before the automatic, if you will, age of emancipation was 19. Now that time frame has been extended to 21. Some of those young people are students that we're seeing here at Illinois State that are within that age range. We would love to see more. Sadly, only about 4 to 6% of children who matriculate through the foster care system end up with a college degree. So we really see our role as helping to support youth in their educational goals. So having, even just for that population alone, having the additional resources that come with being still connected to DCFS really is important. And then also children and young people in general, when you think think of most young people who are 18 and 19, particularly if they've not had family stability, how many 19-year-olds do you think are really capable of making decisions that could affect their entire life around financial management and budgeting and where do they find a job, particularly if they've not had a good educational foundation? So we see that youth, vulnerable youth who are emancipated at 19 or even in some states where the age has been 18, a lot of those young people sadly end up going down a trajectory that we would not like to see. So, for example, homelessness, joblessness, experiencing food insecurity, experiencing early parenthood before they're ready, experiencing incarceration. Also, this particular population of young people are vulnerable to trafficking. So all of those things are important. So we're really pleased to see that our state has moved forward with that bill.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm in studio with Doris Houston, director of Illinois State University's School of Social Work and director of its Center for Child Welfare and Adoption Studies. So Doris, earlier this year, DCFS was under some intense public scrutiny after the deaths of several children who were previously in the Intact Family Services program. I wonder if you can help our listeners understand what is Intact Family Services.
Sure. So Intact Family Services are a specific kind of intervention for families who've had DCFS involvement. So generally, these are cases where there has been a substantiated case of child abuse and neglect, but it hasn't risen to the level where there is an urgent and immediate necessity to remove the child from the home. So, for example, if there was a young parent who just really was neglectful in their parenting, maybe had not been supervising their child, getting them to doctor's appointments, all of those things, of course, are serious. But perhaps there are cases that would be considered moderate or lower level, and in those situations, Intact services are available to support families so that their child doesn't have to go into foster care. I would say that currently about 80% of those services are being delivered by contracted agencies throughout the state of Illinois. So DCFS subcontracts those services to community agencies who would then provide whatever services are deemed necessary for those children.
And do you think that model has served DCFS well, this kind of privatization where you have 80% of those cases being handled by private organizations who are on contract?
It certainly can. Some of the challenges are that oftentimes the agencies are underfunded. Because let's face it, in many cases, when an agency is wanting or proposing services to provide to families or a community, the state wants to see that they're able to provide those services for a reasonable expenditure. So that gets a little tricky because sometimes agencies are being asked to provide really intensive services, ongoing contact with families where they may not have the capacity in terms of funding or even in terms of staff capabilities to be able to do so. When private agencies are involved, the services are diffused across a number of different systems. So it really is a challenge to be able to make sure that the communication flow is consistent, the data is accessible when DCFS hands those cases off to private agencies so that we don't see gaps between when a case is referred and then when it's picked up by that agency. Because sometimes a week-long gap can really make a difference in terms of a family getting started on their service plan. Mm. And then, of course, the courts really have a role just in terms of some intact cases, but then certainly foster care cases that have to be monitored. So that's an additional safety net. But in terms of the private sector, there's a number of agencies that all have to really be on the same page to make sure that our children are safe.
One of the reports you mentioned earlier in our conversation was out of Chapin Hall at University of Chicago. It was focused on intact family services, which we've been talking about for the last couple of minutes. That report found that the caseworkers are feeling that they have limited options with parents who are not cooperating, and those caseworkers are feeling pressure to keep families together at certain times. And Illinois does have a very high threshold for removing a child from a home. We actually, I think, have the lowest foster care entry rate in the country. Why is that, do you think? Is that intentional?
I believe it is intentional. The state of Illinois has, if you will, made a judgment call that whenever possible, children are best served in their families of origin, and that foster care really exists for those situations where a child absolutely cannot be served in their home. So several decades ago, our foster care rates were at approximately 50,000. And so to go down to approximately 17,000 is a good thing. But if we are going that route, we have to make sure there are the services available, readily available for families. You know, our society is facing some really complex problems. Are the opioid epidemic, which really has a direct link into child protection. The flip side, though, is we don't always have enough foster parents and foster homes to adequately serve the needs of children. And every foster home isn't equipped for every foster child. So, for example, some families might do better with small children. Some families might do better with really with more mature middle school age children or older. Several children have experienced trauma, which then may lead to acting out behaviors, and so are families equipped for that? So, while we want to keep children safe, and we must keep children safe, and that's why the foster care system is in place, it is not as easy or as simple as removing a child from their home. And then what we may see, if there's not the appropriate family for that child, is then the child begins bouncing around from one home to the next, and they end up essentially aging out of foster care with very little family stability, very little sense of belonging. So Illinois has certainly gone the route of really prioritizing trying to keep children safely in their homes. But the piece I would really challenge all of us in terms of our state as a whole to think about is that there's a saying that these are all of our children. So to support children and their families, that takes support from our churches, support from our schools, from our coaches. It can't just be the agency because, frankly, there'll never be enough money to cover the needs of vulnerable families who are in impoverished communities, whether those are rural or urban, who are facing these serious problems such as addiction and domestic violence and food insecurity. So I certainly do support that goal, as I said, of keeping children safely in their homes. But we've really got to have the resources there.
Black children remain overrepresented in the child welfare system. I'm curious, how do you think race plays into this? How do you think that we, consumers of the media, people who hear these stories on the news about these incidents, these high-profile incidents, how should we be thinking about race?
Again, as we see in a number of other systems, whether it's the criminal justice system, whether it's the school system, whether it's the medical system, DCFS and the courts that work in partnership with DCFS also have to have an examination of things like implicit bias, and are some families under more scrutiny? Are some communities under more scrutiny than others? So, for example, in McLean County, and this is from 2018, African American children were represented in the population roughly at 12%. Again, keeping in mind that the census is every 10 years, but we have estimates in between. So 12% of African American children in the population, but they made up 39% of the children who entered foster care in 2018. I wish I had an easy answer for you, Ryan. There's a lot of debate. I've been involved in child welfare now almost 30 years, and this has been an ongoing debate in terms of whether we look to the families, whether we look to the community, whether we look to the structural systems that in many times have disadvantaged families of color in terms of bias, in terms of decisions about who gets to stay home and who comes into foster care. There have been some studies that show that there's discrepancy. So, because, you know, we are human, and we all, particularly in our country and in our society, have struggled with the issues of race and racism from the beginning of colonization of this country. So we can't turn a blind eye to the fact that some families may have access to more resources or better resources, or may just be given that second chance if they're having some struggles in their family.
That's Doris Houston, director of Illinois State University's School of Social Work and director of its Center for Child Welfare and Adoption Studies. Doris, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
I'm Ryan Denham.
ISU's Center for Child Welfare and Adoption Studies is the lead member of the Illinois Permanency Project, which aims to reduce racial disparities and improve permanency outcomes for children within the Illinois foster care system.
This time of year, the world gets more colorful. And while we don't all have a green thumb to make a garden flourish, or maybe we don't have a garden at all, we can all appreciate the beauty of a good one. On Morning Edition, you get a bouquet that's more wildflowers than roses, a collection of stories that are totally different, but work together and add color to your day. Weed out uniformity with Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care, exclusive providers of Restore Therapy. Restore Therapy, where your rehab and independence mean more. On the web at heritageofcare.com/restore. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, proving that love is stronger than bullets. Dana Vollmer has the story. Some Illinois gun dealers say the lack of guidelines governing them under a new state law that requires them to obtain a state license and implement a variety of security procedures is driving them out of business or across state lines. Tim Shelley has more.
Todd Vandermeid is the executive director of the Federal Firearm Licensees of Illinois. He says about half of the state's 2,400 federally licensed dealers haven't registered with the Illinois State Police for a new $1,500 license for retail locations mandated under the Firearm Licensed Dealer Certification Act, signed into law by Governor J.B. Pritzker in January. He says many of those 1,200 shops still unlicensed across the state have moved out of the land of Lincoln or called it quits altogether, rather than continue to grapple with a regulatory process they find infuriating and expensive. Federal licenses from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives cost just $300, with a $90 renewal fee every 3 years. The law gave Illinois gun dealers 6 months after passage to obtain a state license. The law also required the state to develop and implement various rules around the new regulations pertaining to gun dealers. But Vandermeid says the state still hasn't published its list of rules governing gun dealers under new law. The deadline to apply was earlier this month.
How are you supposed to operate a business with the threat of felony prosecutions, with the fact that they may take your livelihood away or your business away, and yet they haven't even published the rules? How's it supposed to work?
Under the law, someone who continues to sell guns under a suspended state license or without a state license could be charged with a Class 4 felony if they are caught violating the law multiple times. The first-time offense could be a Class A misdemeanor. They'd also be liable for a slate of fines ranging from $2,500 to $5,000. Democratic State Representative Kathleen Willis of Addison was the main sponsor behind the legislation. She says she shares the concerns of gun dealers across the state. She says the rules should be in place by now, but implementation is up to the Illinois State Police, which ultimately operates under the purview of the executive branch.
We thought we had the correct timing in there for it. Our intent with this is not to frustrate or aggravate the gun shops.
Willis says she believes 90% of the state's gun shops are probably already in compliance with the standards set forth in the bill. She says the intention of the law was to increase oversight and weed out the minority of, quote, unsavory gun dealerships not following best practices. In a statement, Pritzker Press Secretary Jordan Abdeya says the administration is working to implement the law smoothly. The Illinois State Police said it is still working to finalize rules before sharing them with the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules for public comment. A timeline for when those rules are expected to be introduced was not included in an emailed response. The law also requires gun dealers to adhere to certain standards on video surveillance, electronic record keeping, alarm systems, and employee training, though many of those requirements don't go into effect until 2020 or 2021. The law also requires shops to be open to inspection by the Illinois State Police or local law enforcement. Still, Todd Vandermeid thinks it may already be too late to make good for many gun store owners.
I would wager that when we see the September FFL list from ATF, it's going to look remarkably different across the state than what the list from April looks like.
He said many of the gun stores who have chosen to move or close their doors aren't likely to come back even after the rules are implemented due to a lengthy recertification process they'd have to go through with the ATF. I'm Tim Shelley.
This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Charlie Schlenker, and this is Sound Ideas. A resident of Peoria's North Valley neighborhood and young volunteers have turned a home into a symbol of healing for the community in an effort to reclaim and redefine a struggling block. Dana Vollmer has more.
We are helping out a lady named Molly Rice, who runs the Butterfly Garden.
Levi Pataskal is a 19-year-old lifelong resident of Peoria.
She takes care of a lot of different plants, fruits and vegetables that she grows here, and she gives them to people in the neighborhood for free. And she just spreading love all over the place here.
Pataskal is part of a crew of volunteers with the Dream Center's Mission Peoria.
We get a large group of people together, and then for a week we go out and we serve all over the city. And we basically just try to spread the love of Jesus. Obviously every area of Peoria needs a lot of love, but there are some areas that you can see a more obvious need in, and the North Valley area, which is where the Butterfly Garden is one of those.
They're helping Rice maintain the community garden and build new raised beds to protect the plants from lead-contaminated soil. They're also painting a mural to make a statement against gun violence.
This is not the same blue, but it's going to work. In four colors. One side can be a bunch of different colors.
Yeah, we could always add more colors in the sky and make it blotchy.
Because when I think of a mural, I don't think of anything super clean
and like...
So basically the mural on the left-hand side is representing what the neighborhood either currently or used to look like. So it's dull and it's not lively and it's kind of dying, I guess. And so then as we transition and rebuild the neighborhood, it becomes colorful again.
14-year-old Michaela Isabel is on painting duty.
We're using these hearts and the echoes to show we're going to extend it all the way down so that it shows that love travels farther than gunshots, even though it's quieter. And then we'll put the quote and the trees to represent the change in the neighborhood.
Rice grew up two blocks away. She bought this home on the corner of Glendale Avenue and Boris Street 4 years ago.
You know, in recent years, it's gotten a little bit worse. We've seen, had some things happen that affected us personally, and it's kind of rough, you know, and we want to show people that we are not going to let that make us move or, you know, get really down on the neighborhood or anything like that.
For the mural, she chose a quote by author James Mark Miller.
Love is quieter than gunshots, but there's more of it. And that's exactly how I feel about our neighborhood. We do hear gunshots periodically, and sometimes we later on find out that that shot that we heard hit somebody we know and love.
Rice says she hopes the piece helps her community heal.
I want my neighbors to know that my family cares about them. The community, the larger community cares about them. I think a lot of times in our neighborhood, people feel like our neighborhood is forgotten and ignored and neglected, and it is. And I want it to be very clear that I'm not forgetting it. I'm not neglecting it, and I do care about my neighbors. We think that the more positivity and the more love that there is in the neighborhood, and the more people will move in and continue to spread that.
It's Rice's positivity that attracted volunteers like Levi Pataskal.
They're just trying to be a light in here, which is what we need more of in the Peoria area. There are too many people who see Peoria for what it is now, and then they want to get out of here.
Pataskal says Molly Rice is one of the few people he has encountered that see Peoria for what it can become, and the rebuilding starts in her own neighborhood. I'm Dana Vollmer.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas, interviews, and stories with help today from Ryan Denham, Eric Stock, Tim Shelley, and Dana Vollmer. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter, we're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.